Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Seattle, Washington. He began playing the saxophone at age 10. His fourth album, Duotones, which included Songbird, made him an overnight star. His sixth studio album, Breathless, became the number one best-selling instrumental album ever, with over 15 million copies sold. The biggest-selling instrumental musician of the modern era, his name, Kenneth Gorlick, a.k.a. Kenny G. Wow. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the world's coolest jazz saxophonist, Kenneth Gorlick, a.k.a. Kenny G. Wow, what an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, I grew up in Seattle. Just normal childhood. I didn't start saxophone at the age of two. I was just doing my normal things that kids do, go to school, play around after school. I used to ride my bike a lot. Parents, my dad was a plumber. My dad also started a plumbing company for wholesaling things like hot water tanks and toilets and things like that. So he went from being a plumber to being actually a supplier of plumbing and heating and hardware goods. And my mother was a homemaker, so she was home all the time. And I basically lived a very normal American childhood.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
Well, the biggest thing I learned from my dad was, there's a lot of things he said to me that actually were not very were not very helpful in life. And I'm not saying that generally speaking. I'm just saying every parent has some things they say that are not cruel. But the one thing that he said that was very cool was he told me, he says, you know, there's always seems to be time to do the job over, but there never seems to be time to do it right. So if you're going to do something, take the extra time to do it right so you don't have to do it over, which I use a lot in my life. So that's one thing that I really appreciated. And what I learned from my mom, I learned how to make some really nice, delicious food in the kitchen because she was a really good cook, and she used to show me a few recipes. So I now can make food for my kids, and I can tell them it came from their grandmother, she's not alive anymore. My father still is alive. He's going to be 94 in about 4 days from now, 5 days from now.
The greatest generation. So
yeah,
we're with Kenny G. Kenny, in 1966, at age 10, one Sunday night, you watched The Ed Sullivan Show. It changed your life, and it changed the world. Tell us about that show.
I saw a saxophone player stand up and take a solo from a big band, and I just thought that was awesome. And I told my mother that I wanted to play that instrument. I had played the piano before that and quit because I didn't enjoy it. So my mother was a little skeptical at the next musical instrument because my history was that I would start something and quit when it came to music. But that wasn't the case with the saxophone. And when they rented me a saxophone, I immediately enjoyed it and I started practicing. And I've been enjoying the practicing of the saxophone ever since. So that's really why I got inspired to play the sax, was from that one show. I don't know who the soloist was, but it was definitely something that inspired me at that moment.
Also at age 10, you fell in love with the second thing, and that was golf. What does golf teach us about life?
Well, there's a question for Jack Nicklaus and Nick Faldo right there. But if I may answer, I will say that the good thing about golf is that it brings people from all walks of life together. I have had the pleasure of playing golf with my high school friends. I've played with strangers. I've played with President Clinton, spent a day with him. I spent a day with Jack Nicklaus. I've spent a day with Tiger Woods. I've spent a day with CEOs and policemen and you name it. And so it brings people together, and it's an equal playing field, which is wonderful if your handicap is honest, which you hope that it is. You hope that the other people you're playing with, you hope they keep their handicaps as honest as well. So the main thing is that it's a game that allows you to just play evenly with another person, and there's no there's no room for dishonesty. So, you know, if you get a bad bounce, you get a bad bounce. Life gives you bad bounces. Sometimes you get good bounces. Sometimes you get lucky. Sometimes you're not lucky. So it's a really good way of seeing what kind of a personality a person has when you play around the golf with them, and watch how they handle the good bounces and the bad bounces.
And in 2001, you spent a weekend with Phil Mickelson, and the two of you won the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am.
So, I'm looking at the trophy as you say that.
So, what do golf and music have in common?
Well, for me, now this is just for me. Now, some people view golf and playing golf totally different. For me, I like the idea that if you practice something and work hard at it, you get good at it, and the more you practice, the better you get. So with golf, it's an individual sport, like playing a saxophone. You know, there's no team out there that helps me play a good concert. I should say, take that back. Of course, my band is the team, but I'm saying as the saxophonist, there's no team that tells me to play my saxophone better. I have to practice it. And when you're playing golf, unless obviously you're playing a team sport, but generally speaking, you're playing golf, you're by yourself, it's your score, you're playing the course, and hopefully the more you practice, the better you get. So they both appeal to me because they're both in that way similar. I will say this, practicing the saxophone, the more you practice, the better you get. That's true. Golf, the more you practice, you don't not necessarily get better. And that's the hard part about golf, because if you're not practicing correctly, you can practice a lot and not get better. And that's frustrating. So there's where the similarity is a little bit different.
We're talking to Kenny G, whose total album sales exceed 100 million copies, making him the biggest-selling instrumental musician of the modern era. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Kenny G, who began playing professionally in 1976 at age 17 with Barry White's Love Unlimited Orchestra. 1986, Kenny, your first appearance on the Johnny Carson Show. They told you you were to sing two songs, and at the last minute they said, "We have only time for one." What did you sing?
I chose the one that they didn't want me to play, which was Songbird. They wanted me to do a different song, which was a vocal song featuring a singer, obviously, and me playing the saxophone. And when it came to just playing the one song, I decided that I had to give my one shot on the Johnny Carson Show, since I watched it my whole life. I had to do the instrumental that meant a lot to me. So I played my song called Songbird, and it was very not well received by the people on the show that had booked me, because they were excited about me doing this other single that had done pretty well on the radio. So when they heard me play this instrumental that no one had really heard of, they were very upset with me. But fortunately, there was a whole country that watched, and it wasn't just about the people that were booking me on the show in Hollywood. And the whole country decided that they liked that song, and then it became a hit song, and that's the reason I think that you're even interested in talking to me today, Jack.
Here's a portion of Kenny G playing Songbird. That was Songbird by Kenny G. Kenny, the president of Arista Records, was Clive Davis from 82 to 2006. Tell us about Clive Davis.
Clive Davis was the guy that saw me play saxophone solos with a band that they had signed called the Jeff Lorber Fusion. And then in 1982, after I had been playing with Jeff for about 4 years, Clive said, "Why don't you have your own solo deal?" So that's when I signed my own solo deal in 1982. It was in February. And too bad I didn't buy a bunch of French wine back in those days, Jack, because that was the year. So anyway, 1982, I started my record deal, and then I had Clive at my, you know, supporting me all those years. And we did a lot of great things. We made history together, and it was a very, very good relationship where he would give me his advice. he would give me his support, but he was always he would always acquiesce to the fact that it was my career and I'm the artist and I could make the final decisions. He made it difficult to make some of those final decisions when he would tell me my career would go down the toilet if I didn't listen to him. But he did it because he cared and he really felt strongly about certain issues. And there are times where I went completely against what he said and things worked out. And there are many times when I went with what he said and things worked out too. So we had a very good relationship, very, very respectful relationship.
Another long-term relationship starting in 1979 was our mutual friend A.Z. Alexander Zanchik. Tell us about the famous Alexander Zanchik.
He really is famous. He is such a great guy, such a smart guy, so talented. I mean, he really is a fantastic flute player. He really is. His beautiful tone. He does things with the flute that I've never seen anybody do. He's got, he uses technology to do sounds that you don't know of, and he's very playful with his sounds. He comes from a classical background. He's not a jazz player in that sense, although he does do some songs that are jazzy. But he basically comes from a classical background. I think I'm correct with that. So, in my conversations with him, and we've been friends ever since. We played a lot of the same festivals back in those days, and just became friends because he's a great guy and easy to talk to. And so we started to we've done several projects. We know Jeff Lorber is one of our mutual acquaintances, so we both worked with him. And I've done many festivals with Alexander, so I'm a big fan of his, very big fan.
You're doing another one in a couple of weeks, Jazz on the River, the 20th annual. That, if you want to learn more, www.zonjic.com. You're coming to Trenton Saturday, August 1st. Kenny, music is the universal language. How do you explain the magic of music?
You can't explain it. It is just what you said. There's magic involved, and that's what makes music so wonderful. I mean, imagine a world without music. You know, you can't. We love our music. We sit at home, and you put a certain piece of music on, and it relaxes you. It makes you reminisce. Sometimes it gets you excited, makes you dance. Sometimes it makes you cry. It's whatever it is. And sometimes there's music in the car that just makes the drive so nice. There's no explanation for it. I mean, there's 12 notes in the, at least in the scale that most people use. And we musicians, we choose the 12 notes in whatever order we choose them, and we create music and songs. And there's some magic that happens when I write a song that somehow touches people's hearts. For me, it's a wonderful feeling. It's very moving. It touches my heart too, and I think that's why we all love music, because it does really touch our hearts.
Speaking of magic, your sixth studio album, Breathless, became the number one best-selling instrumental album ever, with over 15 million copies sold. That's a lot of bottles of French wine, Kenny.
Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah, that was one of those perfect storms. You know, that record came out. It was funny because just at that time, the technology of recording had changed from analog to digital. And so I was able to do things in the recording studio that I couldn't do prior to that record being released, which would be things like, you know, let's say you record a song and you play it from top to bottom and you love about 80% of it, but there's 20%, you know, you wish you could just fix a couple of notes here, a couple of notes there, just for you, not necessarily for anybody else. And with the digital technology, I was able to do that. So that record was it took me a couple of years to make because I was so hands-on, I was so meticulous. And I think there's somehow those little nuances that I was able to put in that record, along with the fact that President Clinton at the time was running for, he wasn't the president at the moment, but he became president, and he kept telling everybody that I was his favorite musician. So I got a lot of exposure, besides being, obviously, being able to play on the Johnny Carson show again after the success I had. So I got a lot of exposure. Everything kind of happened. The music was there. The digital recording was there. And there was just some magic to it. So there you go.
How many songs have you written? And share with us the process of how you write a song.
I don't know how many I've written. 100? More? Maybe more? I don't write that many, so I don't think that that's a lot for someone that's been in the business now for 30 years plus. So, I mean, that's only like 3 songs a year, so maybe it's probably more than that. But the process is not anything that you can quantize. It's all improvisation, and it's just spontaneous. It's waking up in the middle of the night with a melody. It's driving in the car and hearing something. It's sitting in your studio and trying to write a song, and then it happens. It's being at a piano in a hotel lobby and going, getting an idea. There's no one way to do it for me. And Jack, I wish there was, because then I would just do that all the time and be probably more productive. So for me, it's just the magic happens when it happens.
Speaking of the magic, you are great at connecting with and communicating with your audience. What's the key to that?
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I think it's true. I think I do communicate well with my audience, and I by the way, I think my audience communicates well with me too. So it's a two-way street, and I think that is the key to it. Is that just because you're the artist and you're on stage, it's not a monologue. You know, you're not just dictating whatever that is musically what you're doing. You're not just dictating it to a group of people that are just sitting there absorbing. There's a communication that happens. There's an energy that happens. There's a sensitivity that happens. And the fact is that we're all sharing this music together, and we're all there for the same reason. We want to be moved, and we want to be want to feel some magic. We want to feel our hearts. And I think if you put yourself in that mindset that you're part of the experience, I think that helps with the communication.
We're talking to Kenny G, and at age 10, he watched The Ed Sullivan Show one night. He saw someone play the saxophone, and it changed the world. And I'm Jack Rasulo, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasulo, and we're with Kenneth Gorlick, a.k.a. Kenny G, whose fourth album, Duotones, which included Songbird, made him an overnight star. Kenny, you mesmerize us. You hypnotize us. How do you do that?
I don't know if I do that, Jack. You know, the thing is, an artist is... I think the artist has this kind of an obligation. They have an obligation to be true to their art, their music. I'm a saxophone player, so how am I true to that? Well, I practice every day. I practice 3 hours a day, which I will do after we're done with our interview. I'll get my sax out and start my practicing. Although I may only do 2 hours today because I've got a lot of stuff to do, so this may be one of the days of the week where I'm just a little less. But I practice every day, hours. So that's my commitment. My commitment is to be a really good saxophone player, and try to be at the top of my game every time I step foot on stage. I don't want people watching me and I'm rusty and I'm sloppy and I'm not prepared. So that's one thing. And then play the music that means something to you. You know, don't play music because you think it'll sell. Don't play music because you're trying to, I don't know, do something that's not really you. Do music that means something to you. And I think if you do those things, you're pretty much in a position to mesmerize audiences, because they're going to feel it. They're going to feel that you're sincere and that what you're doing is heartfelt. And I think that that's part of what makes an audience mesmerized.
Speaking of mesmerized, how do you explain your tremendous popularity throughout China, 1.3 billion people, and specifically the song Going Home in China?
Well, this is a good question, Jack. My music is very popular in China, and I've been going to Asia now since 1983, I think. So that would be many, many years, over 30 years. At least a couple times a year I go to Asia. So I've been to Asia well over 100 times. To Japan, probably the most of any of the other countries. I've been to China probably 25 or 30 times. So what happens when you play in those countries is that they start to develop a relationship with you, and I have a relationship now with the Chinese people, and my song Going Home is a song that they play when it's time for the department stores to close and it's time for people to go home from work, that song is played, and it's like a cue, it's a trigger where people go, okay, I'm going home now, because the song is called Going Home. I think they really took it literally, obviously. But the thing about it is that my melodies and the Chinese melodies are similar in some ways, and we connect. And so it's, again, it's one of those unexplainable things, but the fact that I've been going back there so often after all these years and during all these years is that it keeps that relationship alive, and that's why my music is continuing to be popular there. And in fact, I've got another trip to Asia planned in October, so I'll be going back, and I'm going to be in Korea and Vietnam and Singapore, and I think I'm going to be in Bangkok and Malaysia, and also I think I'm going to be in India. So, I do that a few times a year. So I think that's one of the reasons that I keep my connection.
If you want to learn more, www.kennyg.com. And here's a portion of Going Home. Going Home by Kenny G. Kenny, what amazes you the most about the Chinese people?
Well, yeah, the culture is completely different than America. I really do love the Chinese people. I've been around, again, many, many times for, 30 years. So 20 or 30 times I've been to China. I've been to Asia over 100 times. But the Chinese people are, there's a lot of them. And they get things done. Buildings go up very fast. I mean, they build things quickly. There's an abundance of people. And so you're not at a lack for getting things accomplished. You can get things accomplished. Language barrier is a little different. They have a different way of looking at things. So for an American, to solve a problem, we may have a one or two people try to figure out the answer. In China, to solve a problem, they just throw people at it. That's what their commodity is. They got a lot of people. So if there's a problem, then you'll see 20 or 30 people just ready to do something, but they're not sure what to do. So, and it's great. It's great because the enthusiasm's there. Everybody's trying to, they want to accomplish a lot. And, that's one of the things I really like about the Chinese people. They're meticulous as well about, they're musicians, played in China for one New Year's, and they had one of their top violin players play with me, and he was amazing. So, there's just a lot of attention to just doing things well and doing things quickly, which I like.
I've played the piano since I was 8, and I believe that great music comes as much from the heart as it does the fingers. How important is the heart in playing the saxophone?
Well, the heart's the most important thing playing any instrument, but you do have to have your technique down. You have to have it together. So I'm of the opinion that there's both parts. I mean, you can be a very heartfelt musician, but if you have lousy tone and lousy technique, we love that you have a great heart, but it's not going to make that much difference because nobody's going to want to listen to what you have to play. So you have to be able to at least accomplish a set of mechanics that are at a certain level. But once you do that, then the heart is the most important part because, there's a lot of very accomplished musicians in the world. Why are there a handful that you want to hear? Well, because given the fact that they all have very good technique, there's a handful that touch your heart. Why? Who knows? But that's the magic of music. So you can listen to a very technical rendition of a song, and you can listen to a song that's also equally as technical, but for whatever reason, it just touches your heart, and that's when the heart comes into play. But you can't just have a heartfelt stuff. You have to at least get to a certain level of mechanics, in my opinion, and technique. So that's how I look at it.
You've listened to all the great entertainers over the last 40 years. Was there one or two that just is above everybody else?
Well, I did open up for Miles Davis on many occasions. Back in the late 80s, I was his opening act for a while, like a good 6 months or so. We did a bunch of dates together. And he was very special. I mean, he just had it, you know. He'd play two or three notes and the people would go crazy. You know, it's Miles Davis. He puts the mute in his trumpet and he plays, and half the time he has his back to the audience and people just didn't care. They just loved him. So he had a special thing going on, which I thought was amazing. So that was one. Let's see, who else did I see that I really liked? Singers. I mean, I did get to see a Luther Vandross concert, and he's amazing. He was amazing, just really connected with his audience. So that was great. And, I would pick those two as, like, my top people that just kind of, they amazed me.
Certain nights, it just flows. You've got the magic. Other nights, it's not there. What do you do when it's not there?
Yeah. What do you do when it's not there? Well, that's when you have to get yourself and you, as I said before, you have to be at a certain level of proficiency, of professionalism, of technique, of mechanics. So what happens is when the magic isn't there, you're still a great musician. And you're still, my band, I say that as far as all the guys in my band, we're very accomplished musicians. So when the magic isn't there, we're still great musicians, and we can play. So we're playing it, and it's going to be played well. It may not have that very special something for whatever reason. And again, it's organic, so you can't make the heartfelt stuff happen. You can't make the magic happen. And when it doesn't happen, we play, we just still go through the motions. We're trying. We hope it comes back. But a lot of times what happens is that when it's not there and we still keep playing, it comes back. It ends up showing its face at some point. But you stay positive, and you stay excited, and you keep putting the good energy out there, and just knowing that you can, you know, you're basically using your technique and your musicianship as your base, and just know that you have that, and then it just gives you a lot of confidence, lets you relax, and when you do relax, then the magic seems to seep in again.
We're talking to the world's coolest jazz saxophonist, Kenny G, and here's Kenny performing a portion of Forever in Love. That was Forever in Love by Kenny G, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Kenny G, whose song Going Home is an unconventional mega hit all of China every working day at 5 p.m. Kenny, were there one or two performances these past 40 years all over the world that stand out above all the others?
Wow. Oh, gosh, that's a lot. That's a lot to ask. So let's see. There was a really nice performance in Barcelona. And the auditorium was really beautiful. It had all these carved statues and faces inside. I mean, it was one of those things where you'd look at it and you knew it probably took somebody or a team of people 5, 10, 15 years just to carve all that stuff just for the inside of this theater. So I just remember that being an amazing place to play, and the acoustics were fantastic. So that's one thing. I did play at Carnegie Hall once. And I remember my mother, who isn't alive anymore, she was alive and she was there. So that was a beautiful moment to share. So, I mean, I think those two pretty much stand out as far as, like, if you're asking me to remember concerts. Also playing at Albert Hall in London. It's a beautiful place. It looks like Carnegie Hall inside, except I'd say even a little bit more beautiful. So the setting, I think, of the venue has a lot to do with how I remember the concert. So that was pretty special. Also playing at the turn of the millennium at Times Square, I was up on a scaffold and I played Auld Lang Syne, at the top, and there was, you know, 2 million people down, I guess, Fifth Avenue or whatever avenue it was, and that was pretty special. So those are some cool moments.
Cool moments. Do you ever pinch yourself? You earned an accounting degree from the University of Washington. The first year in high school, you didn't make your jazz club. You ever pinch yourself?
You know, figuratively, yes, I do. I don't really do it, I don't really do it with my fingers, but yeah. It's amazing. You know, I never knew where my path was going to take me. I mean, even in high school, I did not make the band my first year. I went back and practiced and somehow came back the next year, and I was first chair by far. So it just goes to show you, it's like timing, and sometimes you develop in certain ways differently. So for whatever reason, when I was 16 or when I was 15, I wasn't that good. But when I was 16, I was really good. And why? I don't know exactly. But something happened and it clicked. And then all the things that kind of have come into, you know, just kind of lined up for me when it comes to the music and the timing and, you know, people wanting to hear instrumental music and radio stations wanting to play it. And now it's not the same. Now in 2015, it's not like it was in the late 80s. So I was there when the timing was good. I do pinch myself, Jack, and it's basically, it's just kind of like being in the right place at the right time. And why was that the case? And there's really no answer. It's just something to, I think the key is to appreciate it and to be grateful for a good life, which I have. And, you know, I've got two great kids. I live in a nice place in Los Angeles. I get to go out in the world and play my music, and that's all I have to do. I don't have to do any other kind of work, so that's awesome. So, yeah, I'm pretty lucky.
If you want to learn more, www.kennyg.com. Kenny, how has your saxophone playing evolved these last 25 years as a solo artist?
Well, at first I was just coming off being in Jeff Lorber's band. So I was trying to learn what I wanted to play because I didn't have anybody telling me, you know, what to do and where to play and what kind of solo to do. It was really up to me. So I kind of had to develop my own style and sense of what I liked. So now that I've been doing that for the last 25 years, it's just like every time I play, it's kind of up to me to decide how I want to do it. And that's how I do it. I practice what I want to practice. I work on the kind of music I want to work on, and it just kind of happens. But I practice every day for 3 hours, so that's going to, you know, if you do anything for 3 hours a day, you're going to get better at it. So that's how I look at it.
I played golf 3 hours a lot of days, but I don't know if I'm getting better. You, in an earlier segment, you said you missed out in the early 80s buying French wine. Well, you did okay. You had a friend in Seattle by the name of Howard Schultz. He had an idea. Tell us about Howard Schultz.
Howard Schultz I met in, 87, 86, 88, somewhere around there. And his idea was that he wanted to take the one Starbucks store. I mean, maybe there was a couple, I think, but as far as I knew, because I only knew the one Starbucks store down in Pioneers, or down at the Pike Place Market in Seattle. That's the one I knew. Maybe there was a couple more, I can't remember. But he wanted to take that and expand it and take it to the world. So I met Howard, and he was, at that point, just excited about expanding. So he was kind of talking to people and looking for people to invest in his idea. And when I met him, I just thought, this is a very charismatic, very smart, great guy. And we became very good friends besides all that. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if I'm going to invest in anything, I would invest not because I know anything about coffee, but I kind of know things about people. And he strikes me as the kind of person that's going to be successful and hardworking. And he just seemed, like I said, he had that magic. He had that charisma. And obviously he's proved over these years that is true. And he still has it. So it was, again, very good fortune for me to be in the right place at the right time, and good thing I grew up in Seattle.
A few years ago, we had another great artist, performer, Jeff Daniels, on the show, and he talked at length about taking risks and following your dreams. Talk to us about taking risks and following dreams.
Absolutely. That's the whole thing. But the thing is, you have to, got to be in a position to do that. I mean, it's easy to say, but some people, you know, unfortunately, they don't have time, or they don't think they have time. You know, if they've got to work 9 to 5 and barely making ends meet, it's hard for them to say, oh, you know, I'm going to take a risk and follow my dream, because they're just trying to put food on the table. So it's one of those things that yes, it's absolutely true to do. And you just hope that you can get yourself in a position where you can take that risk. So, you know, I was fortunate that I was in a position where I grew up in a household where my parents were taking care of me enough where, I mean, we weren't super, super well off, but just, you know, it was enough where I could play my music without having to get another job, and I could see where it was going to take me, and that was a great thing. So I got a chance to take a risk of not doing a regular job and following my dream of playing music. And I was fortunate that my family was in a position where I could do that. So, but I would just say to anybody, you know, the biggest rewards come from the biggest risks. So if you feel like there's no way you can take a risk, maybe there is a way somehow, and that will be the time where you would hopefully reap a very big reward if things go your way, which I would hope they would.
If there's a young listener that says, Mr. G, I know what my dream is, but I'm afraid to go after it because I don't want to fail, what do you say, Kenny?
Well, that's not a reason not to go after it. If you're in a position to go after it, go after it. You know, whether you fail or not, I mean, you can fail and it just leads you to another direction that takes you somewhere else. So your dream might be, well, I want to become a recording artist and make CDs. And you go out there and for some reason it doesn't work out for yourself. Oh, but at the same time, somebody heard you play and now you are not just a solo artist, but you're part of a band. And this band becomes the biggest band in the world. Okay, well, you didn't get your dream of a solo artist, but here you are and doing this wonderful thing. So failure just leads to other paths and gives you the chance to continue. So being afraid to fail is unfortunately one of the main reasons people don't take risks, in my opinion, it's one of the reasons you should not stop yourself from taking risks, because chances are you are going to fail. I mean, I tried to join my high school band. I failed. Well, I got better next year and I got in. So if you fail, it means that you have a chance to regroup, and who knows where it's going to take you. But that's my view is, don't let the fear of failure stop you from taking a chance.
Kenneth Gorlick, a.k.a. Kenny G, thanks for all the entertainment and enjoyment you've given to hundreds of millions of people throughout the world these past 40 years. Keep practicing every day.
Hey, Jack, thank you. I appreciate that. And yes, sir, I will.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahom. Believe it.